Good morning.
Good morning.
It is a lovely morning. So this morning I'd like to take a fresh look at the Bodhisattva vows. And if you've come here before on a Sunday morning or a Tuesday evening, you're familiar with the Bodhisattva vows. They're printed on your program and we chant them after each lecture. And the reason I'd like to talk about them, even though they get talked about a lot, is that I don't want them to become stale. I've recited these vows hundreds of times, I think, maybe thousands of times, I don't know. And I would like to think that every time I recite them, I open myself to them anew. But I'm not sure that always happens. So I would like to take a fresh look. And how can I do that? Well, I sat with that question for a little while. I sat in meditation and just kind of held that question in my mind to see what would come up. And I decided I would ask two questions about each of these vows. And the first one is, what does each of these vows look like in a given moment, at the moment of recitation? And the other one is, can these vows be applied to the challenges arising from a specific life situation? So I'll be looking at them from two angles. One is immediate, as in what's going on in this moment, and the other one plays out over time, as in how am I going to deal with this present situation. And by the way, I'm indebted to Taigen Dan Leighton, who wrote a book about bodhisattvas called Faces of Compassion, for my take on the bodhisattva ideal. So a little background to begin. Please bear with me if this material is familiar to you. The bodhisattva ideal is a basic ideal of Mahayana Buddhism. The ideal in the Buddha's time was the arhat, which was the solitary, enlightened figure. And when Mahayana Buddhism arose a few hundred years after the Buddha's time, there was a perception that maybe more focus was needed on reaching outward, on the practitioner interacting with other people and helping to end suffering in the world. So not a solitary figure enjoying bliss, but someone reaching out to others, engaged with them. So a bodhisattva vows not to enter into a state of bliss until all beings have entered into a stage of bliss. The bodhisattva willingly stays in the world of suffering and works to end suffering there. And the vow to do this is called pranidhana. So the bodhisattva takes that pranidhana vow at the beginning of his or her career and then takes the path leading to enlightenment, and also takes the four bodhisattva vows. And these vows have inspired many generations of practitioners. Here at MZMC, we chant them each Tuesday, Saturday, and Sunday morning, and each Tuesday evening as well, and at other times. They're part of every initiation ceremony, ordination ceremony, and Dharma transmission ceremony. So you take these vows when you take a formal step along the path here. So these vows are about being kind, and I think we all want to be kind. Maybe sometimes we resist a little bit being told to be kind. I remember when I first heard about the bodhisattva path that probably a little part of me thought, wait a minute, I'm really not ready to give yet. The reason I came to Buddhism is because I need help. And frankly, I'm kind of a mess. I can't give right now. But the irony is that if you do give, it ends up being the way of ending that mode in which you need help. You don't end the mode of needing help by getting help. Instead, you go outside of yourself. So you don't need help anymore. So giving is the path to liberation. And it's not really that giving is sort of ironically and indirectly a way of getting. It's that giving erases the distinction between giving and getting. And I think the Bodhisattva ideals are a kind of a default for many people. I think they are for me. When I'm faced with a decision, I don't need to review my whole worldview. Every time that happens, I can simply remember that I've taken these vows, that they came from a really deep place, that it took me years to get to that place, and I can trust my prior thought processes. I can trust my heart, and I can follow these vows. So my choices can be based on this. What is best for all beings? What will end delusion? What will be entry into a Dharma gate? What will become the Buddha's way? So it's helpful to have a default like that. But this being Zen, we always question everything, especially defaults. And if we have a default, there's a danger that it'll go stale. So let's look at each of these in turn. Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. So what strikes me immediately about this one, and this has been noted many times, is that it has a sort of vastness to it. An inconceivable vastness, in fact. And sometimes the Bodhisattva vows are called the inconceivable vows. If beings are numberless, how can I possibly free them all? Essentially, I'm vowing to do what is impossible. So when we take this vow really opens us up. It takes us to a place of logical impossibility. It takes us to a place of wonderment, where we have to suspend our ordinary way of looking at things and find something else. It is designed to open us up. And it's designed to help us to contemplate the infinite and to throw ourselves into our work of relieving suffering with no thought of outcome or reward. Just doing the work. Beings are numberless, and we can't possibly save them all. And yet we're vowing to do so. So we're freed from any idea of accomplishment. We don't need a result to keep going. We will do this work no matter what. If we lose every day, we're still going to come back another day and do this work in the same way. Beings are numberless. Results are immeasurable. It's the moment of doing that counts. And Tigan Dan Leighton says, this spaciousness helps us to interact more clearly in our ordinary realm. So we carry our sense of the infinite and the inconceivable with us. And when we do that, our actions, when we do specific things, are informed by a knowledge of the interdependence of all things, of the mystery of all things. And so we have respect for the interconnections, we have respect for what we don't know, and we act wisely. We see beyond that small thing in front of us. And we can make a limited vow, as Tigan says, where we try to work in one specific area, where we try to relieve one certain kind of suffering. As in, I'm going to be present with this one particular person who is suffering. And those vows are good, and they're part of the practical aspect of being a bodhisattva. We need to do these things. But they can be limiting if we're not careful. A limited vow, if we're not careful. Tigan says, the limited vow, while carried out as a practical expedient, is self-defeating if we are willing to avert our gaze from those beyond the boundaries we have constructed. So we choose to end one kind of suffering, and we isolate that from all other suffering, and we concentrate on it. So it's possible to pick out that one thing and work on it and feel good about it, but then maybe we let other things slip from our mind and we just look at that. And we can do better than that. We can pick one thing and work on that and feel good about it, but also let it be an opening to awareness of all the other problems of the world as well. It's the small thing, and it's the vast inconceivable at the same time. So when we help one being through our limited vow, we are also helping all beings through our bodhisattva vow at the same time. So if our limited vow helps us to end the immediate pain, say we're helping our brother-in-law to get some food, but we say, that's that, we've done that, he's got his food, it's great, and it prevents us from opening up to the vast universe, then we're not going to ask, well, what causes and conditions brought this situation about? Why is it that he's been hungry? Is there something we can do about the causes and conditions? Are other people hungry? Is there something we can do about that? So the spaciousness of the bodhisattva vow helps us to act more effectively. So let me ask my two questions with respect to saving numberless beings. First, what does this vow look like in a given moment? What does it look like at the moment we recite it? Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Well, when I recite it, I don't want to be thinking about my personal commitment. I don't want to be thinking about what it means. There's really not much time. Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. And I don't need to be sort of scrunching myself up with this vow, as in, I really, really vow this, which I have a tendency to do. And I don't need to be planning how I'm going to save all beings either. What I would hope to do as I recite this is to simply open myself up to this inconceivable vastness. If I can do that, I'm truly making the vow, and I'm truly living the vow at the same time in that moment, and the vow is complete. And perhaps all beings are saved in that moment. But then they'll still need to be saved again in the next moment. So in that moment of recitation, I think opening myself up in that way is the best thing I can do for all beings. The vow is the action. At that time, the vow prepares me for further action at a later time. There's a time for each thing. There is a time to simply open ourselves without any thought or any plan, to simply be, and there's a time to take specific action in accordance with our vows. In recitation, we open our heart, and later, when we act in a limited way, we can recite the vow again as we act, and we can open our heart again, and we're living the vow. And the vast inconceivable is present in the limited action. And as we eliminate a small amount of suffering, we eliminate all suffering. Or if that seems impossible, if that seems like too much, we can say that we eliminate a small amount of suffering, and as we are doing that, we are creating the conditions for eliminating further suffering outside of this limited situation. So this vow, which seems to be about future action, is also about right now, and the distinction between present and past and future is eliminated. It's all here now. And later, when it's time to act, it will again be all here now. So the other question is, can this vow be applied to the challenges arising from a specific life situation? So I'm going to change the pace maybe a little bit here. And talk about something less esoteric and a little more practical. And I'm going to give you an example of a practical situation from my own life. And this has been on my mind a lot because it's about me and it feels really big. And that is, and many of you know this, I have the happy prospect of in about 2 months I'm going to retire from my day job, which I am really excited about. And I'll be able to spend a lot more time at home with Kathy. I'll be able to spend a lot more time here. I think it's going to be pretty nice. But retirement is kind of a mixed blessing, too. I think it's going to be great. I'm so excited about spending more of my days here at Zen Center. I was able to spend all day Friday here and all day yesterday. It was such a great day yesterday. first a board meeting and then a work day, and we were working outside. I had a little more time to put the finishing touches on this talk. Then we had a potluck last night. We turned the Zendo here into an art gallery. It was a great community event. It was just a beautiful day. And I'm looking forward to more of that. And I'm looking forward to kind of giving my left brain a rest a little bit. I'm in the legal profession, and it's sort of this relentless left brain stuff. And I'll need a little of that for administrative work. But I'm going to meditate more. I'm going to relax. This summer, I'm planning to weed the path out there, take a little break now and then, and keep the sidewalks swept. So I think it's going to be good. And no one who retires ever says, oh, it's really terrible, you shouldn't do it. But I think there's probably a dark side, too, and it's under the surface. So I try to let that come up and show itself. And mainly it's uncertainty. You know, this is a really big change. I've been working at the same place for 25 years. I don't know exactly what it's going to be like. And, of course, a little bit of me wants to control it all. And a bigger part of me knows I simply can't control about it. But, you know, there are fears like, what if I run out of money? What if things aren't what I expect? What if my time immediately fills up and I never get that little respite I thought I was going to get? What if that happens in the first week? What if I never get to weed the path? So, beings are numberless, vowing to free them. What does that tell me about this particular challenge? I think it tells me to bring a mind of inconceivable vastness to this situation. So what characterizes that mind? Well, that mind, I think, does what it can do. It doesn't have expectations. It allows things to unfold. And there is some trust there. It doesn't expect perfection. It takes it as it comes. It is persistent, and it is joyful, or at least there is the potential for it to be joyful. And it knows that there is a time for each thing. There's a time to open to that inconceivable vastness, and a time to act on our limited vow. And it says, it will be all right. It will be all right. We will do these things one at a time, and our ideas about what we're doing and what we have to do next are balanced by and the same as what's right in front of us, whether it's a patch of sunlight on the floor or whether it's that last little bit of melting snow on the north side of the building. It was there yesterday. I think it's still there. We should all go out and say goodbye. So, how do we resolve the problem of not enough time? It's a patch of melting snow. So the second bodhisattva vow is, delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. What are delusions? Tigan says, we are caught by delusion when we become attached to objects of attraction or aversion. So it's about attachment. Because when we have an attachment, that's something extra. That's something about us, about our desires and our aversions that we are bringing to the situation. That's not about the object itself. It's something that is obscuring our view of the object. Because we bring our own stuff, we can't see the thing in front of us. So delusion is a kind of misunderstanding about the value of things. If I think a new house or a new car or a new spouse is going to solve all of my problems, then I'm not seeing those things for what they really are, and I'm not going to make good decisions. I have an exaggerated view of what they're going to do for me. And if I think that something which looks like a misfortune is going to be all bad, well, I'm probably not being open-minded enough there. Because think of all of those times when something happened to you and it seemed to be very bad, and maybe it was, but surprising good things came out of it. Maybe to the extent that ultimately you end up being grateful for it. And an example I can give of that from my own life is one I've given before, which was the difficulty I had when I was going to law school. It was really, really difficult, and it almost did me in. I almost couldn't complete it. But in the end, it brought me to this spiritual path, and I just kept on going. And now I am grateful. I am grateful that that adversity happened, even though it was terrible at the time, and it made me very uncertain. So we'd never know where things are will go. We try so hard to predict what the future is going to be based on our past experience, and we are so often wrong. We're so often wrong. So we get this idea of it's got to be this way and it can't be that way, but half the time we don't know. And these delusions are inexhaustible. We are hardwired to seek what we desire and to avoid what we don't like. And it happens again and again, and no matter how smart we are, or how enlightened we are, or how self-aware we are, we're still going to act in accord with our delusions. It's going to happen. And yet we vow to extinguish delusions. We will always work at it. We're not going to give up because it's hard. Now, I could imagine saying, beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Well, that is simply impossible. I cannot possibly save all beings, so I'm not even going to try. I don't agree with that at all, but I could imagine saying that. But I can't imagine saying, delusions are inexhaustible, I can't possibly end them, so I'm going to give up, I'm just going to live a life of delusion. I don't think that's going to happen. You can't do it. You have to keep working on delusion. So what does this vow about delusions look like in the moment when we recite it? Well, it's the same opening to the vast inconceivable, but it has an added dimension, which is self-awareness. We can't extinguish delusions unless we're aware that we're deluded. So in the moment of reciting this vow, we can open ourselves to an honest and vulnerable place. In the moment of recitation, it's not the time to examine particular delusions, but it is a time to open the heart to the truth that we are deluded, that we will always be deluded, and that we will always work on not being deluded. Open the heart. Oh yeah, that again, that again. I had convinced myself there that I was not deluded, but I still am. So we open the heart to examining the eye. And you know, it's interesting that we used to have a different translation here at Zen Center. When I first came here, instead of saying delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them, we said delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to extinguish them. And so we took the I out of it in order to eliminate the distinction between the path and the goal. Instead of I vowing to eliminate delusion, the vow is simply occurring. It's not from the perspective of the self. So we're getting a little head start on no self there. And so what the I does in the moment of recitation is it opens up to not I. So then how can this second bodhisattva vow be applied to a specific challenge in my life? Well, there are many delusions in connection with retirement that I find myself slipping in and out of. There are many kinds of non-helpful thinking that occur. People ask me, are you counting the days until retirement? Are you crossing them off in the calendar? And I say, no, that's a terrible thing to do. I don't want to be thinking about how much time I have left. I don't want to watch the clock. I want to be present with each of these days until my job ends, all 48 of them. See, you can't help it. And if I think retirement is going to solve all my problems, and that's pretty easy to slip into, every time something bad happens, it's like, oh, well, that'll be over in 7 weeks. That's not going to happen anymore. Things are going to be fine. But if I'm looking at it that way, I, of course, am not seeing retirement for what it really is. And if I dwell on what could go wrong, I'm not really seeing it accurately either. So taking this vow in the way I've described can help me to accept that there are myriad thoughts and feelings here. Some are helpful, some are not. I have a limited ability to sort out the helpful from the non-helpful. I am not going to solve this problem by sorting. I'm going to solve it with an open, accepting heart that sees what each day brings. What is it today? What are today's delusions? What is today's patch of sunlight? What is today's melting snow? What's going to come? Will monsters come? Will I invite the monsters in for tea? Will they become my friends? Will they prove to be my liberation? But who is there to be liberated anyway? So, Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. So one definition of Dharma is the Buddha's teaching. A Dharma gate is anything that brings us to that teaching in the deepest sense. In the deepest sense, I think the Dharma is not about the Buddha's discourses or the teachings themselves or the various lists of things or the words that teachers say here. I think the Dharma in the deepest sense is about being awake. It's about being present in the world. The Dharma is about right now. That's what all of those discourses and teachings and lists are pointing to. So a Dharma gate is anything that brings you here now to this place with nothing extra. It's like when you look at the lake, our beloved Bede Makaska here, and you see, if you've looked the last couple of days, and I think it was more striking a couple of days ago, there was this strange kind of gray-blue color that the ice was, kind of a slate color. And I thought it was really astonishing to see that. And it's during that moment when you're startled by that, before you say, oh, I know what that is, that's melting on the ice, that's melting of the ice. There's that moment where you just see it, you're startled by it, you're fully present with it, and you don't know what it is. That's your Dharma gate. And the Dharma gate is anything that helps you to open up to that. Dharma gates are boundless, and they are everywhere. The lake is dramatic, and it's beautiful. It's been a Dharma gate for thousands of people, probably for thousands of years. It's the kind of Dharma gate that we think about when we think about Dharma gates. It's a beautiful, natural thing. It's easy to see it as a spiritual thing, but of course, Dharma gates are everywhere. Your seat on the bus, your awkward and lurching approach to that seat, the way you're drawn to someone you've never met, the way you're startled by someone who is unfamiliar, your uncertainty, your fear, your boredom, even your desire, even your delusion. These things are Dharma gates if you're only present with them. So you can't lose. You can't lose. Even delusion comes up. If you're present with the delusion, if you see the delusion, okay, it's here. It's here now. Vowing to enter them. To enter them, we have to see them. To see them, we have to be open to them, not just to the pretty Dharma gates, not just the quiet ones, but to the raucous ones, the scary ones. And any moment, no matter how weird or miserable or unzen or desire-filled or mundane or confusing can be your Dharma gate, if you only fully embrace it without reservation, with your heart-mind, not your thinking mind, with your heart-mind. So, these vows are aspirational. I know I'm going to fail time and again. I know that's going to keep happening. I've done it before. But I also know that each failure is a Dharma gate, a total Dharma gate. So, I welcome failure. It's inevitable. I might as well welcome it. So, what does the vow about the Dharma gate look like in a given moment? At the moment of recitation, again, it's an opening of the heart. It's a willingness to say that this, whatever it is, can be my Dharma gate if I only open myself to it. Opening myself just means bringing nothing extra. So this vow has an element of letting go. You can't look for a Dharma gate. You can only enter the Dharma gate if you let the Dharma gate come to you. You can't say, oh, I'm going to look at the lake and I'll probably be surprised. No, too late. You're already up in your brain. Better to look at your shoes, quick. And how can this vow be applied to a specific life situation? Well, this one kind of has a different tone from the first two. The first two are things we want to avoid, suffering and delusion. But this one is more about opportunity, an opportunity to become open that is present every moment. And whatever challenge in life we face, it's very helpful to remember that there are opportunities that come with these challenges. There are many Dharma gates. Even mourning a loved one can involve beautiful moments that set beautiful things in motion. I never told my brothers out loud that I loved them until our dad's funeral. That's when I started. And it happened in a moment. And it wasn't something I planned. But there it was. And it was a beautiful thing. And you never know when a Dharma gate will swing open. And my retirement, I know there are going to be many Dharma gates. I'm pretty sure they won't be the ones I expect. And I'll do my best to let them come and open my heart and recognize the possibility of joy. Allow for that possibility without needing it or expecting it, the Dharma gate of joy. Maybe I'll see you there at that Dharma gate. So Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. Vowing to become it. The Buddha's way is life in accordance with the Buddha's teachings. It's practicing his way. It's not understanding his way. It's practicing his way. So we must become it. In vowing to become it, we incorporate the Buddha's way into our own lives, into our daily life, and we find expression of the Buddha's way in the midst of our own personal situation. This is a very personal vow. And how do we become it? I think we look to the three vows before this one, and they tell us how. By getting out of ourselves, through vowing to free all beings, by becoming self-aware, through acknowledging our own delusions, through being open to whatever Dharma gate manifests itself. If we do all of these things, we will become the Buddha way. And the moment we do these things, we are the Buddha way. And it's unsurpassable because it's based on giving. Generosity is unsurpassable. And in the moment of recitation, what does that look like? Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. Buddha's way is always this moment here, fully embraced, fully lived. What does that look like at the moment of recitation? I would say yes. It looks like whatever this moment of recitation is. It can't be predicted or talked about. So we'll see, won't we, when we chant it the next time. We'll see what the Buddha way is at that moment. And how do I apply this vow about becoming the Buddha way to my particular situation? I think that if I do these other three things, I vow to free all beings, I open my heart to the vast and inconceivable, I vow to exhaust all delusions, I open my heart to my own situation in an honest way. I accept and forgive my imperfections, my delusions. And if in vowing to enter the Dharma gates, I open myself to the possibilities of each moment, it will follow that I will become the Buddha way. And distinctions disappear. And the idea of retirement is gone. There's just this. There's continually being in the moment. And it seems abundant. The future will come when it comes. I'll plan when I need to plan, but now it's this. It's just this. And next it'll be announcements, and then it'll be tea, and tomorrow I get to go to work. And that's what I have to say. And I would welcome any comments, questions, poetry. If anyone has something to say. Yes, Benton.
In geometry, when you have a point that's an infinite distance away, it is no longer a destination, it is a direction. And that's how I see the Bodhisattva vows. It's a point an infinite distance away, but it's a good direction to go.
Yeah, that's very good. The point, it's a direction if it's an infinite distance away. That reminds me of when I got initiated a long time ago, and I was talking to my teacher, Shohaku Okamura, about that. And I was really new, and I referred to initiation as a goal, as in this is a good goal for myself. And he said, initiation is not a goal. Initiation is direction. Vow is direction. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yes, Steve.
Wait, Ted, well, it's kind of pretty inchoate, really, but the relationship of thought and thought and speech to delusion. Because I mean, some of your comments seem to think, we can't psych ourselves up for the lake epiphany, but and, I'm thinking about Gerard Manley Hopkins, and he had these kind of epiphanies that he put into poems, and he really psyched himself up for these kind of poem epiphanies. And they're really kind of, they're great, but there's a lot of Gerard Manley Hopkins that is ignoring a lot of ordinary moments. And yet he's pretty good at getting a lot of epiphany out of everyday moments. But they're kind of special moments. But I guess there's all this talking to yourself that is kind of helpful and then sometimes isn't. And so I'm wondering if you have a thought. And Zen, of course, is always messing around with koans and things. So I don't know if you have a thought about that or not.
Yeah, so there's that thinking and kind of talking to ourselves that we do. Some of it's not helpful, some of it is. I think if I were to say, Ted, you're going to now go out, you're going to look at the lake, and you're going to have a big moment. It's probably not going to be helpful. But I can talk to myself and say, Ted, you are going to pursue opening your heart. And you are going to think about how to do that. And you're maybe going to meditate more. And you're going to talk to your teacher. And you're going to do certain practices. You're going to do metta practice or something like that. So you're talking to yourself. You are using that thinking function. You're kind of creating the conditions, opening yourself so something can come, something can appear, so this kind of enlightenment can occur. You're not willing enlightenment, but you're creating the conditions to allow that to happen. And our thinking and our planning and our practical frame of mind can help us with that.
Because I was at the Chicago Institute of Art, and I didn't even want to go in. And then I kind of went in as an afterthought. And then I all of a sudden wound up in one of the great Impressionist galleries and the Van Gogh gallery. And it's because I hadn't really, I'm going to go do Van Gogh. It's like, I didn't want to do Van Gogh. And all of a sudden, Van Gogh blew my mind.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. There you go. That's why your shoes can be so exciting. I mean, yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Steve. Yeah, Stephanie. Sorry. Sorry if I didn't see you. You're way in the back there.
I didn't want you to feel bad when someone...
Yeah. It's cool.
I want to say that, I think you also, in your talk, reminded us what the motivation is for all the reminders and the self-talk, at least one. The obvious one is that we want to help ourselves. I think that's just how we are hardwired. But the other one that's maybe not so obvious, and as you say, is, so... it's such a gift, is if we think about why should we open ourselves up. If we just do it for ourselves, we won't really feel what we can feel. But if we can find a way, if we find someone to dedicate ourselves to, or something to dedicate ourselves to, you know, then that actually can become expansive, and that can become the reason why you would do it in the first place. And then it can actually even help to explain when we have to do it. Sometimes we may have to do it when we really don't want to. But, if, you know, something in our heart might say, well, but if you don't do that, you're really small. And not that that being small is not human, but you can be someone bigger for someone else. And I think that's, you know, what I found, that's what was also in your talk.
Yeah, thank you. That's very nice. So in this talk we do to ourselves, kind of talking to the small self, we bring in other people. It helps to keep us motivated. We don't simply, it's not just for ourselves we're doing these things. And I think that can really make kind of a profound shift in our motivations. Yeah. I don't know if I summarized. I'm kind of summarizing because I'm not sure everyone in the Founders Hall heard. I don't think I did justice to what you said, but I hope it's okay. She said, no, actually, you didn't. I think she's kidding me. Yeah. Okay, Guy.
A somewhat related question. How do we go about saying that he's as messed up as we are?
Yeah, as messed up as we are. Well, we don't wait till we're perfect to get started, that's for sure. Yeah, we just put one foot in front of the other, I think. Yeah, I don't know. We see what's around us. We take care of that, but we don't just limit ourselves to the problems we see around us. I think we have to engage in some pretty deep reflection about what the deep problems are and try to do something about them. Yes.
Yeah, I would say that question opened up for me a bit. When I studied how Renang kind of approached the Bodhisattva vows, and he said that about especially the first one, vowing to save all beings in my mind. It's like perceiving all these beings already is a problem, right? Seeing beings as separate, right? Bodhisattva is supposed to, that's the whole gist of the Bodhisattva, is that they
right.
All beings, knowing that there are no beings.
Right, right.
So like when Renang says, you know, vowing to save these beings in my mind, it's all about, it brings it back to perception, right, from the beginning. Took a little bit of the weight off for me.
Yeah, thank you.